Welcome to Trial Lawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glovsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we speak with some of the best trial lawyers in the country. Today, we have a special treat. We've got John Gomez. John is an excellent trial lawyer who's incredibly talented, incredibly genuine and authentic and real. And he's going to share with us some of his experiences in a case that he recently tried. And John also has an incredible personal story from his very humble beginnings to Yale Law School to becoming one of the preeminent plaintiff's lawyers, preeminent trial lawyers in the country. So let's get started. Welcome to Trial Lawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glovsky, and we're here with a phenomenal, amazing trial lawyer, John Gomez, who tries cases all over the state and probably all over the country and has a phenomenal firm in San Diego and is a graduate of Trial Lawyers College and a truly successful and real trial lawyer. John, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
John, can you share with us a story of a case that had a profound impact on you? And as I look across, I can almost see the smile on your face, knowing that a couple of days ago, you had an amazing, heroic result for clients, and I can feel it on your face.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. It was actually just yesterday morning. We got the verdict at about high noon in Bakersfield. And so that's the case. You know, it's near in time to today, and it came at a good time for me. And the result, you know, really will make a profound difference in our clients' lives. So that's the case that I'd like to talk about.
Okay. You mentioned that the case came at a good time for you. What do you mean by that?
You know, the last couple of years have been challenging for me. You know, I went through a divorce. I just ended a relationship with someone I was dating after that. We, as a firm, had gone through this horrific losing streak of trials. I personally had lost, I think, 4 trials in a row, which I'm not really accustomed to. That really hasn't happened for me before. And I can look back and kind of understand why each of those trials were lost, looking at them sort of objectively. But I was kind of in a place where I felt a little snake bitten, like that I had lost it, or, you know, that I just wasn't going to get another big win again, you know. And it's kind of how I define myself professionally. I feel like it's the best thing I do. And then to get, you know, loss after loss after loss after loss is tough. And so going into this one, you know, I felt great about the case. I finally had a good case to try. You know, I'll still try really hard cases, and maybe that's not good for me, but I'll still do it. And then we get in the middle of the trial, and we're doing well, and we start to believe that, you know, we can pull a rabbit out of a hat, and sometimes you just can't.
So how did you get up, you know, when you lose several trials in a row, which all real trial lawyers have done because they try cases, but how do you deal with that?
You know, I think it's tough. You know, it's easier for me now because I have a much closer relationship with God, you know, and that's helpful to me. I just place faith in him and kind of his design for my life. You know, and I also just have a core belief in values in the sense that if I just keep trying cases and doing well and doing, you know, good for good people, then over time things are going to work out for me. And so those two things kind of kept me going. In this circumstance, I just finished a trial the Wednesday before I started this trial. And we had lost, predictably. It was an impossible case, but, you know, I thought maybe we had a shot. So we try, we lose, you know, and then we lose on a Wednesday and we start this other trial on a Monday. So there it was good just to jump back in the saddle. You know, that was helpful to me.
So tell us the story of the case that you just tried.
So, you know, I meet this guy, Matt Faulkner, in Cambria at a TLC regional. And one day, you know, he calls me up and he says, John, you know, I know that you tried this Starbucks slip and fall case with this mild traumatic brain injury and got a great result. I go, yeah. He goes, well, you know, I got this case with this guy who slipped and fell in an El Pollo Loco. And I go, okay, you know, like, you're a TLC guy, sure, you know, let's do it. And the case kind of sat around forever. But then finally, you know, it's getting a little bit close to trial. It's like, you know, a couple months out. So I drive up to Bakersfield. I'd never been to Bakersfield. And I was like, okay, can you give me a flight to Bakersfield? And they were like, there's no flights to Bakersfield. You know, you got to drive. And I'm looking at the drive. It's like 5 hours. I go, this is brutal. You know, I heard about Bakersfield too. You know, I'm from San Diego. So, you know, I wasn't looking forward to it. But I drive up there and I meet this couple, Bill and Elaine Kidd, and they're the most salt of the earth, solid people ever. And I just fall in love with them instantly. And I get so excited about the case, you know. I'm like, you know, I think this is one where we could really make a difference. And so I go up there, I meet with them, you know, I visit with them a while. We bring them back down to San Diego. We have a courtroom here, and we do some exercises with them, kind of recreate some scenes, and I start understanding the case a little bit and the impact on them. And then, you know, it's Wednesday, we lose that case, and Thursday I drive up there, and I check into this hotel, and Matt's firm is right down the street, and we start working on this case, and it just, it starts happening. You know, we get into jury selection, and the judge lets me do a mini opening statement. That's a mistake for the defense, you know, and it, you know, I get a feeling with this jury that they're going to be able to listen.
Your mini opening statement is what, 90 seconds?
I think he gave us, I remember I timed it, and he wanted 3 minutes. So it was like 3 minutes. It was like 180 seconds.
Okay. Give us that mini opening.
Man, how did it go? I think I said something like, you know, we represent Bill and Elaine Kidd, lifelong Bakersfield residents and husband and wife. One night, Bill and Elaine shared a bottle of red wine at home and decided they'd go down to El Pollo Loco to get something to eat. And you'll hear that when Bill got up to go to the bathroom, he slipped and fell and hit his head. He went to the ER but went home that day. But then later on, he started having problems. And you'll hear that those problems got worse and worse and worse to the point where he needed a surgery to drain, you know, excess blood from his head. So in this case, we're going to be asking you for many millions of dollars to make up for the harm that he suffered as a human. We also represent separately his wife, Elaine Kidd, and despite the fact that Mr. Kidd's seeking millions of dollars, she's also bringing a lawsuit. She's bringing a lawsuit for harm to the marriage that she has with Bill, and we'll be asking for many millions of dollars for her case as well. And so, you know, how do you feel about a case like that? In a little while, I get to talk to you, and I'm hopeful that you can be real honest. You know, hold on to whatever feelings you have right now and share them with me honestly. You know, a slip and fall. How do you feel about a slip and fall? How do you feel about a guy that drank wine and then bringing a lawsuit? How do you feel about a guy who looks perfectly well as he sits here today, yet I'm going to be asking you for many millions of dollars? And so, you know, does it sound suspicious? Does it sound like too much money? Does it make you feel uncomfortable or like I'm trying to do something I shouldn't be doing? You know, whatever it is, just hold on to it and share with me honestly when I get up to speak with you again in a little bit. Something like that.
So tell us the story. How did you go about trying to discover the story of the case?
You know, we brought Bill and Elaine down and their daughter, Sarah. And we just, you know, first I was having a hard time understanding how he fell because there were conflicting accounts that didn't make sense to me. You know, I've done a lot of slip and falls, and there was some suggestion he had, like, fallen forward, hit his head, and then fallen back. And so that did not compute for me with a slip and fall. And so, you know, we just set up the scene, you know, like here in the courtroom, and he kind of walked through it, and, you know, he couldn't go, you know, down like he did, but he recreated it as best he could. And that helped me understand kind of the dynamics of the fall, which was an important issue in the case. And then, you know, we just started doing scenes of life before and then, you know, life after, kind of doing some little exercises about all the various, you know, ways his body and mind were being affected by the brain injury.
What kind of exercises?
You know, we'd kind of like, I don't know, psychodrama type stuff, you know, where I think, you know, at one point he's, I don't know, I do a weird thing with a mirror and he's kind of looking in the mirror and like it's him looking in the mirror before he gets her and then him looking in the mirror after he gets her and what's the mirror saying back to him and stuff like that. And, you know, kind of different pressure points on his body by virtue of with all the kind of, you know, participants in the drama kind of participating to replicate everything going on with his body and mind, you know. So
say more about that.
So say, you know, he's got a headache, you know, and so he's got a headache and so one of the actors is the headache and the headache feels like blah or makes him feel like blah, and so they're doing that. And then at the same time he has a convergence problem with his eyes, so his eyes see all kind of weird, so someone's doing that, and he can't filter noise, so someone's doing that, and then you can just see, you know, that whole confluence of things that he's dealing with all the time. You know, it just helps you, as you know, if you can see it, you can understand it better and you can present it better. And so you know, everybody's got a little role. Someone's, you know, the overwhelming noise, someone's, you know, the blurred vision, someone's, you know, the headache, someone's the can't remember, someone's the biting your tongue, and, you know, just doing that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, I like to just spend a lot of time with them, you know, and like I'm sure many of the people you talk to do. And so just, and with a brain injury client, it's a little hard because you don't want to wear them down too much. They have limited reserve. And so you can only do it in chunks. You know, it's like peeling an onion back. So, you know, we did that, you know, for a couple of days. And then we did a couple focus groups where they would actually, you know, we'd do a little mock testimony because we put them up in the witness chair and they get to get used to communicating with a jury.
Yeah, because we're actually sitting in your courtroom, which is a full courtroom in your office with a gallery of, what, 30 chairs for the audience and counsel tables and a jury box and the witness stand and the judge's chair. I mean, we are essentially in a courtroom.
Yeah, and it's good for you know, lay, you know, witnesses like our clients, because, you know, we can do exercises with them where they're connecting with the jury. You know, we try to create the feeling in them that these jurors are their friends, and each little story that they provide to the jury is like a little gift to them. And so they may do like a human connection, like shake their hand, you know, go down the line, shake their hand and tell them a little story, you know, to the point they get really comfortable with that concept. You know, they're not scared of the jury. They're not trying to hide from the jury. They're really connecting and recognizing that the jury just wants these little gifts of knowledge so that the jury can help them. You know, and so we'll do little exercises like that. When we bring in the actual jurors, like the mock jurors, they're not going to go shake their hand, but they're in that zone. You know, so we use the courtroom for that. And the courtroom's a good place to do the psychodrama because it's big and open. But then we can actually bring them in and put it into action, you know, in front of strangers. And that's helpful.
So you get to trial. You've done your mini opening statement. Take it from there.
Yeah, so the judge really doesn't put any time limits on us for a voir dire. And I think under the new law, he can't, but, you know, some of them still do. But he just kind of lets us go. And, you know, I wanted to talk about safety rules and how some employers will look the other way with safety rules, you know, to save money. And I got a lot of traction with that up there. You know, there are a lot of kind of blue collar, you know, workers that have had that experience. You know, so on liability, you know, I really got a lot of good traction with that. On the money, you know, and I had like a few that really tore into me pretty good, which is always fine. You know, I don't care, whatever.
You're talking about in jury selection.
Yeah, some jurors.
What did they say?
You know, there was this guy, because I was starting with the burden of proof, and I'm saying, well, that might be kind of tough. It may seem unfair that we don't have to prove that much, especially if we're asking for millions of dollars. And so this one guy's like, yeah, that doesn't sound fair. You know, that doesn't sound right to me. If you're asking for millions of dollars, how can you just prove it by 51%? And he was just kind of digging into it pretty good. He got excused for cause. But for the most part, like, this veneer was way less hostile than I've seen. You know, it was like what I hear was the good old days, or what I hear sometimes Los Angeles is like, you know, it was like a relatively friendly group. You know, so we talked to him about slip and falls. We talked to him about alcohol. We talked to him about brain injuries and lots of money for a guy that looks fine. We talked to him about a wife bringing a lawsuit for money. You know, and a few women, you know, don't like that. But for the most part, you know, and the group that I'm left with to choose from is pretty good, which, you know, hasn't happened to me for a long time. And so I'm thinking, you know, I have a pretty good group here. I have a good plaintiff. The facts are pretty good. You know, this could line up. You know, I was thinking that right there. And so we get into strikes, and we, like, pass, like, four or five times in a row. And so, like, the defense is in a big hole. And then we start strategic, because we wanted to get a few on that were a little bit deep, and we're able to do that. And so the way that the 12 are configured, man, I'm like, man, I could work with these people. And I had this one dude up in the corner, this welder, that, like, I had a really good connection with, who really talked a lot about employers looking the other way with safety and how important safety was for him, because he also taught welding. And so that guy stayed on, and a number of other jurors that I thought were really good stayed on. I talked to Danny Rodriguez, you know, because he's from there. I went out to dinner with him. No, I went to breakfast with him before trial. And we were talking about correctional officers. And, you know, you would think, oh, you don't want correctional officers. But he's like, these guys are okay, you know, because they're always bringing claims, you know. And so there's this one CO in the front. I had a good conversation with him, and I was like, okay, I can work with that guy too. So, I liked the jury a lot. So that was a good start.
So was there a time in the trial that was memorable or meaningful?
Yeah, you know, the most memorable part of the trial was the very last piece of evidence. Because, you know, our theory was they would start using these hoses in the kitchen prior to closing. That was against the rules. Because then they would use them to clean the grills, and then they would get water and grease all over the floor. And that was immediately adjacent to a walkway, you know, for customers. You know, like there was this little door that went from the kitchen right to the walkway. And so in our case, our theory was that the cook had been hosing down and then had walked out to clean a table, and that's what my guy slipped on. And so all these managers were just denying it, that they ever broke that rule. And I was set them up. And so we kind of thought they were still doing it. And so like the first or second day of trial, we sent an investigator over to the store before closing with a video camera. And he videos them spraying the grills at like 8:30. They don't close till 10. And then he catches them the next day. And so every one of these managers, I'm like setting up the impeachment, you know, in fact, it's happening to this very day. Cooks are spraying the grill, right? And they go, no, never. I go, you deny that's happening to this very day? And they go, yes. And so that happened like four times. But the judge was kind of giving us a hard time. And so I didn't put that in my case in chief, you know, that arsa brosa. But then in their case, they called this district manager their corporate rep. And I kind of thought they would. That's why I held back on it. And they call this guy, and he denies it. And so then defense rests, and they go, do you have any rebuttal? I go, yeah, I do. And so we should probably discuss it. So I go in the back, and the judge is like, it's coming in, it's impeachment. And I go, I was thinking to myself, whoa, like when's the last time a plaintiff ever got a good ruling? You know, like I've had Sabrosa shoved up my ass so many times. And we finally get to use it. So like the defense lawyer is going crazy, but you know, there's nothing she can do. So I had the investigator in the hall, I put that guy on, and the jury's like looking at it like, you know, they can't believe it, you know? So that was pretty memorable. You know, like that's how we ended the evidence, with them with their pants down, like getting caught lying. So that was nice.
That's beautiful. So why was this case meaningful to you?
Meaningful because I needed the win. You know, I had not won for a while. I'd lost a number of trials in a row. And it went in so well that I thought that if it didn't go our way, there was something wrong with me or the system. You know, I was about ready to give up. Even though I'm pretty confident, I'm pretty good. You know, I just was at that point where I'd just been getting kicked in the head for so long. You know, so it was meaningful to me in that sense. It's also meaningful in the sense that, like, this family really needed this. Like, they were on fumes. I had a similar case with a couple. Main earner had a brain injury, too, and it was the same thing. And I saw how the verdict just changed their lives. And so for them, you know, like it's a huge life changer, you know, and they gave him, you know, he had $177,000 in medical expenses, and they gave him $13 million in non-economic damages, and they gave the wife $3 million. And that's just going to make such a difference for them. And I see, especially with people with these mild traumatic brain injuries, how a successful resolution of litigation can empower them, you know, because they think a community believes them, and it can just help them get their life back on track. You know, so it's like really good for me, really good for them, and really good for my firm too.
John, there's a lot of lawyers out there that are struggling, and we don't know each other very well. But I do know that you went to Yale Law School, and my sense is you had a less than privileged background before that. Could you share with us a little about your story, John Gomez's story?
Yeah, sure. So it's true. I did go to Yale. You know, how on earth I got there, I have no idea. You know, I just feel like God has sort of blessed me, you know, both with extreme hardship at times and, you know, bountiful blessings and others. So I grew up here in San Diego. My dad was in the Navy. My parents split up pretty early. And I just had what I would call a series of kind of successively bad males in my life. You know, my mom was kind of bouncing from guy to guy, bikers, you know, type people. And, you know, just grew up dealing with abuse and poverty, hunger, you know, all those things. And, you know, like, but, you know, played sports and, you know, that got better as time went on. So I graduated high school basically looking to play college football. That was like pretty much the end of my aspirations. And I got hurt my senior year in high school. So I had to play at a junior college and I got hurt there. And so basically I had to end up playing at USD.
University of San Diego.
University of San Diego, which is a non-scholarship 1-2-A program. But, you know, at some point, I kind of got dialed in academically. You know, I just started caring about school. I mean, the reason is actually my dad told me that he said something like I was going to end up in prison. And I was that made me mad. So I was like, I'll show you. And so I'm not going to end up in prison. I'm going to do better than you. And so I did well in school. And then, you know, got into Yale. And from there, you know, kind of the rest is history. When I came out, you know, I worked for a big law firm, Latham & Watkins in Los Angeles, because I just thought that's what you do. That was a grind, but I was making a lot of money, you know, relative to my upbringing. And there, from there, but I've at some point said, okay, I want to try cases. So I came back down here. I was a federal prosecutor for like 4 years. And then went to the plaintiff side, you know, and yeah, growing up was rough. You know, it wasn't super pleasant all the time. But, you know, I feel like that stage of life kind of gave me a lot of grit, a lot of determination. And so when things like this happen, when, you know, I go through a divorce and, you know, lose a bunch of trials and, you know, the firm's on fumes, you know, I know those times will pass because I weathered much worse storms, you know, as a kid. So, you know, in a sense, I think it was a good lesson.
John, what advice do you have for young lawyers out there?
You know, I think probably the best advice that I could give, you know, in terms of sort of your practices, I just think there's no substitute for time in the courtroom, time in trial. Like all the greats have huge time in. Like people, like probably who, the person I would consider, you know, to have had the most sort of, you know, acclaimed success using these methods is probably Nick Rowley. You know, and people are like, think that Nick is just this like crazy savant, you know, and he is, but he also tries cases like crazy. You know, Brian Panis tries cases like crazy. Like these people, you know, grind. They grind the game, and they sometimes lose a bunch of cases coming up, you know, but they develop, you know, this game. It's like being a fighter. You know, you got to have time in the ring. And so you can't like go to a seminar and pick up a trick, you know, and like think you're going to be able to pull that off in trial. You can't go to the trial lawyers college and say, oh, I'm going to do, you know, first person opening and think that's going to fly every time in every venue. And it's really just time in. And so I would say just try as many cases as you can, you know, because like for me now, I can, that case took me 3 days really to get ready for, you know, and I crushed that defense lawyer just because I've tried, you know, now over like 50 pretty long jury trials. So I would say that, you know, and I would say, you know, there's really, as a person, just really try to find something other than law that gives you fulfillment, you know, whether that be a family or whether that be, you know, taking care of other people or whether that be, you know, a higher power or religion, because the law is going to let you down, you know, from time to time. And so if you don't have something to fall back on and to validate you, then probably you're not going to be in a good place, you know, mentally or physically. So those are probably like my two nuggets of advice.
Well, John, thank you so much on behalf of your clients. I mean, you've got an incredibly powerful story. Your use of creativity and spontaneity is obvious. And you've given me and all of our listeners a great gift today with your words of wisdom. So thank you.
Thanks so much for asking me to do it. I'm blessed. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.